I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as part of our ongoing conversation about important public health issues, we're going to talk about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. My guests are Carl Ellison, president of the Indiana Minority Health Coalition, Stan DeKemper, a community health advocate and addiction expert with Mental Health America Indiana, and Jocelyn Whitaker, a community leader from Marion. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Carl Ellison. He is the president of the Indiana Minority Health Coalition. Stan DeKemper, who is a community health advocate and addiction expert with Mental Health America Indiana. And Jocelyn Whitaker, a community leader from Marion. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you here.
Thank you.
So we probably ought to, we have done several shows on, obviously, the opioid epidemic and its impact here. But I think it is always wise to assume that not everyone was listening to those shows or was taking notes. So I'd like to talk a little bit first about the scope of this problem with Indiana. I think Stan probably or Carl, either one of you can talk about when this hit and how it began to manifest itself. Stan, I'll throw it to you first.
Okay. Well, I've worked in the addiction arena since the 70s. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I've seen two wars on drugs and an opioid epidemic now. And the first war on drugs was then-President Nixon declared war on drugs in about 1970, somewhere in there, I think. I don't know the exact date. And the second war on drugs was the cocaine epidemic in 1989. Then President George Bush declared war on drugs again. And now we have a opioid epidemic that is not called a war on drugs anymore. It's called an opioid epidemic. And I think that really, if you understand that, gives you a picture of how the minority community, African American, Latinx, other minority communities fit into the issue. I worked for the state, and I used to audit addiction programs back in the 70s and 80s. And at that time, most of the treatment programs, specifically methadone treatment programs, which treat opioid, they were the only kind that specifically treated opioid epidemic addiction then. 95% of the people in those programs were African American. And I've the last time I audited programs for the state was 2012, and at that time, 95%, these are just rough numbers, but 95% of the patients in those programs were white. And what we've seen is a changing of the color of opioid addiction. That doesn't mean that African Americans are no longer experiencing opioid addiction. The research shows that African Americans experience opioid addiction at about the same rate as white Americans do. But what we've seen is a change in how bureaucracy, federal government, state agencies, et cetera, address the issue. And now instead of an illegal activity. It's focused on more as a health issue. And I think that has a lot to do with who's showing up in treatment programs and so on.
Carl, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, Stan lays out the history very, very well. It is probably notable that the opioid epidemic, at least in this state, certainly got its notice in Scott County. Mm-hmm. So it sort of took on a public face as a rural epidemic.
A rural white epidemic.
A rural white epidemic, right. Yeah. But if you talk to Hoosiers from around the state, it's getting hard to find somebody, anybody who doesn't know somebody who's been impacted by this, either a family member, an acquaintance, or someone. So this epidemic has really become more universal. I want to reemphasize Stan's point. Previously, we referred to these from a public policy point of view as wars on drugs, with the presumption that we could arrest our way, we could punish our way by holding people accountable who chose to use drugs and became addicted. Looking at it as a public health phenomenon, as we do now, calling it the opioid epidemic, perhaps means that we'll have a more enlightened view. But for minority populations, we remember three strikes are out. We remember the longer sentences that resulted in more imprisonment, particularly of minority males, for low-level drug offenses. So there's fundamentally this notion that drug treatment or drug approaches to drug the drug issue creates an adverse impact on minorities, where punishment and accountability is most often the stick, versus prevention and access to treatment. So our organization that exists to eliminate health disparities comes at this from a health equity point of view, mm-hmm. in that while for minority communities, particularly the black community, we are not that we're late to this phenomenon, but it was noticed first among white populations in the state. But all the data we have suggests that, as Stan indicates, that it is affecting black populations equally. So our concern is that as we go forward and we create more treatment opportunities, there's more diversions, whatever they may be, that minority citizens get their fair share of an opportunity to recover versus more, if you will, punishment, more adverse impacts that are not felt by everyone.
Jocelyn, can you talk a bit, because this, you know, as Carl and Stan have laid out, this started as primarily not just the state's attention, but the nation's attention was focused on Scott County, and at least the initial sort of coverage and attention focused on it was, this is something that has hit rural America now, and it's touching people in these small communities that, rightly or wrongly, the popular perception was that they were less prone to the problems associated with addiction. I know, obviously, that was a myth, that addiction occurred just about everywhere. But did that mean in communities such as yours that people did not get the attention initially that they needed in attempting to deal with this problem?
The people did not get their attention needed for this problem initially, and nor are we doing a good job of it now. We went back. I had the coroner to pull 4 years of stats from 2014. In 2014, we had 12 deaths. We had five that were male, seven that were female.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went a step further. Four Caucasian males, one African-American male, and that was 2014. And seven Caucasian females. The average age for the male was 45.8. For the female, it was 42.2.
And just to clarify, these are people who died.
These are people
as a result
died.
Of an opioid overdose.
Right. This was not a revived mm-hmm. person. It was one whose life was taken because of an addiction.
This is Grant County.
This is Grant County.
Okay.
This was Grant County.
So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to make sure people understood your point there. Mm-hmm.
This was Grant County. Then in 2015, our deaths rose to 20, from 12 to 20. And in that, we had 19 Caucasian males, 2 black males, and 1 Hispanic male. The oldest to die was a Caucasian male at 69. The youngest Caucasian, it was a male, he was 21. We see the rise of the claiming of the death of young people and what's happening. Then in 2016, we had 20 to die. 2017, we had 26 to die. And we had it from different drugs and so on. So in our area, we have had from 2014 to 2017, in the Caucasian population, it has been greater. In the Hispanic, 2, 1 female and 1 male. In the black community, it has been 7, 1 female and 6 males. But you see the trend rising. In the late 70s, early 80s, we had a lot of blacks who were dying in the streets from heroin. And there was a war on drugs, but it was not an epidemic. But when that line crossed, and looking at it from not just a male standpoint of view, but from an overall standpoint of view, we saw a decline, but the money was not put there for that. Now the money is following the epidemic, but the problem that comes or arise are the clinics that we have serving the people, or are they just administering the drug? Is the therapy there? Is the psychology there needed to help the citizens who have problems? And if you look at ours by communities, you will notice it's not Marion County that's the highest. You have smaller counties like Scott County. Grant County is very high in the use of opiates, and the number of people who come in from the surrounding counties to buy or procure the drug itself. And what type of drugs are they ODing from?
And Stan, I want to come back to you. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Grant County, and by my math, that means in the space of 3 years, we've seen a 233% increase, right? It's 233% of what it was
in 2014. Your math. All right,
well, that's dangerous, but you know, is it an outlier, or are we seeing those sorts of spikes everywhere in the state?
Different counties. From time to time, Poole County numbers, especially if I'm doing training or working, I travel around the state and work in different communities. Scott County, of course, in terms of HIV, Hep C, all the health indicators, has one of the highest rates, but there are about 4 or 5 other counties that have comparable rates. So the rates are not all that different. They're alarming in every county, but some counties have a higher rate. And just focusing on Scott County, I don't think until Scott County had the HIV problem that people were really worried about it. And when HIV hit Scott County, it became a national story. CDC, SAMHSA, and all the federal agencies were in there. State energy was put on it. Historically, the state of Indiana has not put any money into addiction treatment. All the public treatment money has come from the federal government until 2015 or 16, when the Recovery Works legislation was passed, which put $10 million the first year and $20 million each year since in public treatment. So it's only been 2 or 3 years that we've had any state money put in to the addiction treatment.
Is it making an impact? Is that state
Well, Scott County, I work in Scott County. We've got recovery coaches down there every week from Scott County that we train. And there has been a tremendous increase in community support for recovery and recovery strength built in Scott County.
We are talking about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Carl Ellison. He is the president of the Indiana Minority Health Coalition. Stan DeKemper, who is a community health advocate and addiction expert with Mental Health America Indiana. And Jocelyn Whitaker, a community leader from Marion. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. As part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues, we're talking today about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. My guests are Carl Ellison, who is president of the Indiana Minority Health Coalition, Stan DeKemper, a community health advocate and addiction expert with Mental Health America Indiana, and Jocelyn Whitaker, a community leader from Marion. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. So before we went to the break, we were talking about the counties, communities that were hit the hardest. Scott County is the one that always, you know, dominates the attention. But, Carl, you've got some numbers that show that Scott County is far from alone.
Oh, absolutely. This is 2016 Indiana State Department of Health data, which traces the death rates due to drug poisoning involving any opioid. And the state average per 100,000 is 11.8. So 11.8 per 100,000 in terms of the death rate is state average. There are about 12 counties that were above that number. The first one is Wayne County, the Richmond area. It's like 42.1, so it's significantly higher than the state average. Then next is Floyd County in southeast Indiana, 26.0 per 100,000. Then Clark is 20.7, so Floyd Clark are kind of in the same neighborhood, so they're comparable rates.
And bedroom communities for
exactly.
Louisville.
Yeah. And then continue with the southern part of the state, next up is Vandenberg or Evansville, which is 18.7%. Then, interestingly enough, there's a central Indiana cluster. Boone, 18.6%, Marion, 16.6%, Grant, where Joyce's is from, 16.4%, and Madison, 15.5%. So there would appear to be some geographic significance to also the rate. And then going on down, the remaining ones that are above the state average are St. Joe, 15.2%, Porter, 14.3%, Howard, 13.3%. And the remaining counties, including Scott, are below the state average. So this data simply illustrates that the not only is the phenomena impacting the whole state, but it is impacting urban and rural areas to different degrees. But these particular counties are well above the
average. And also hitting the suburbs, too. It sounds like we tend to think of this country as a divide between cities and country, but there's that whole suburban mix as well. So, you know, in some ways these figures speak to the scope of the problem, but in some ways they don't capture all of it because they capture the absolute worst-case scenario, that someone has died as a result of this. They don't reflect the numbers of people who are living with addiction or fighting addiction but have not died, you know, and the damage that that does to their families, to their own lives, to their careers, and all of that. What kind of toll do you see in Marion, Jocelyn, not just among the people who die, but those who are on a daily basis having their lives affected by this opioid epidemic?
Let's talk about our first responders. after the incident in Ohio when the person got the fentanyl in the powder state and the first responder died, and the precautions needed to take to revive a person. Think about the toll of seeing that. Think about the toll on our police and fire department trying to help somebody that they revived at 9 o'clock and they're back to revive them at 2 o'clock. Think about the families. We have had families with some of our young who refused to put their child's obituary in the paper because they didn't want people to know. But yet we have Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram and Twitter where everybody is seeing the information already. At some point or another, that child, that person who died from an overdose was a hero to someone, and to not put and celebrate that child's death because we are so angry and we don't want people to know. We had a very brave parent. She was a stepmother whose daughter died from an overdose, and she was a realtor in our community, and she starts speaking out about the problem. It took a lot of courage. She talked about the situation. The first time her obituary was in the paper, they put her with her two young daughters. So that's putting a face with a family and so on. And it has no social, economic, or class status. It affects all of us. And I would hope, as a parent myself, that I would never be so ashamed that I could not celebrate my child's homegoing because he had a problem. All of us have family members who have problems. It may not be drugs. It may be something else. But if you're a religious person, you know, there go I by the grace of God, because it could be either one of our children. There are five adults in this room. Mm-hmm. We could have a child who is affected, or a husband, or so on, or somebody who is chronically in pain. That starts this cycle of abuse of drugs.
Stan, walk me through the pathway. And I realize every individual has his or her own story, but is there a typical path toward opioid addiction, something that, you know?
Well, there's many pathways into addiction and many pathways into recovery. And so one of the things I think we make a mistake sometimes when we try to generalize and say, this is the issue or this is the factor. They're what we call health people. Carl probably is familiar. Social determinants. There are a lot of social determinants that people attribute to opioid addiction, which could be family issues, which could be school issues, which could be poverty issues. There's a lot of those kind of issues that may feed into it, but I don't think there's any one or two factors that lead to opioid addiction. One of the things I would sort of like to get back to a little bit is I've noticed we've drifted away from talking about the minority community. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten sort of global here. I don't know if it's the time to bring it back or
no,
not.
No, it is. It is.
Historically, what I've seen in all my years in addiction is that minorities, African Americans, Latinx, other groups, tend to get the criminal justice effect when they have a problem with addiction. They go to juvenile. I worked at an adolescent addiction treatment center on South State Street here. It's not here anymore, but it was kids that had insurance or money. Mm-hmm. And most of the kids in there were white, and the kids that went to juvenile with the addiction problems were generally African American. And
was that the, I'm sorry to interrupt, but was that the sort of the stigma question that Jocelyn was referring to? I think she was trying to talk about the minority impact in that there is this fear on the part of some members of our our community defined by race or ethnic background to say, okay, I got a problem, because it doesn't mean that you get, you know, sent off to the equivalent of the Betty Ford Clinic. It is that you go to juvie instead.
Yeah, and my experience is that there historically have been the two silos. If you were African-American, you went to jail. If you were white, especially if you were middle income or above, you went to treatment. And even in the criminal justice system, there's issues. We were in a meeting recently with the Department of Correction, and we said, and I've gone into Department of Correction and done some training in there with both inmates and staff, and we noticed in the addiction treatment programs, there weren't many African Americans in the addiction treatment programs, even though they make up maybe, this is just off the top of my head, maybe 40% of the population in prison. They don't make up 40% of the treatment clientele. And what is it about, even in prison, why African Americans are not getting treatment? I think there's some issues, deep-seated issues, that our country has that affect not only us out here in the street, but in corrections, the whole system.
I want to say to our listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. If you want to join the conversation, call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Carl, I want to ask, because picking up on Stan's point, and I think Jocelyn's point here, there's already let's face it, with addiction, there is an inherent stigma with that. It makes it difficult for some people to step across the line and say, I need help. Need help with this. But it sounds like there is an additional barrier here in terms of for minority Hoosiers, because they have all sorts of reasons not to trust the system, not to think, okay, instead of getting help, I'm likely to get, thrown behind bars or treated harshly. Does that complicate the task of trying to get people who need that help to come forward and get it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, trust for health providers is not new. Particularly in the Black community, I think trust is still a major problem. And some of it is that the provider you deal with, the party you deal with that wants you in the system, probably doesn't look like you. And may or may not be sensitive adequately to all of the social determinants of health that Stan referenced that are real, that are felt and touched every day. But more fundamentally, I think that we still remember legal segregation. We remember the crack epidemic and the force of the criminal justice systems on minority populations. And even Stan points out, African Americans make up 9% of Indiana's population, but about 40% of the prison population. So there's just a lot of real life inequities that make it difficult to trust. The system itself doesn't seem to have a more coherent way of addressing minority populations, because, as Stan said, the tendency still is that if you're involved in drug addiction and you're Black, you're more likely to be faced by the criminal justice system. Because of social determinants of health, you're less likely to come from a family support system with the resource of a middle-class family. And so you'd be graded less worthy, if you will, of diversion or other activities because you don't have a support network. So there's a mountain of barriers which, when added together and given history, all suggest that the system has to find an extraordinary way and a more sensitive way to reach out to these populations, but above all, has to do its job to assure that the outcomes are equal. To carry this a little forward, the state just got approved its HIP 2.0 waiver that, among other things, adds $80 million to expand treatment. One of the things I'd be curious to know is whether minorities will get their fair share of those new treatment beds, because if history is to be the harbinger for the future, that extra benefit for this state to address opioids will not be equally shared. And so I think our organization is going to challenge the Family Social Service Administration, the governor, and others to keep race ethnic specific data so we know to what extent are the prevention resources we have, the treatment resources being adequately shared. And if not, then work with us to figure out how we address that. Absent some proactive effort to change inequity, history suggests that we'll just continue.
So I want to ask, and I'll stay with you for a second, Carl, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on, given that absence of trust and, you know, in the short term, how do you try to work past that? You know, I don't know any of the three of you well, but you all strike me as good-hearted people committed to trying to serve the folks in your communities. You know, whether they trust the system or not, if they're addicted, they need help. And somehow, I suspect all three of you want to try to give it to them. How do you work past that issue of trust? I'll start with Carl, and then Stan, and then I'll give Jocelyn the last word.
Okay. Well, our organization often comes at this from a system point of view. So one of the things we'll be doing over the next several months is carrying out a number of town hall or community conversations like this one around the state, where our objective is to get all the key parties who don't necessarily routinely talk around the same table. So it'd be nice to have the prosecutors, the police chiefs, the sheriffs around the same table as addiction experts like Stan and community people like Joycelyn, the folks that have Motherwit, et cetera, to just talk about what should be the approach in each county. We can actually have county-specific strategies to not only reach out to people, but also to assure that there's access to treatment, diversion for everybody. I don't know any way of going about it other than to try to get the human beings on the same page, get them talking. And it's consistent with our history that if we all band together, we tend to make progress.
Stan.
Along with what Carl said around systems, I think that's where we really need to start. We need the community input and the dialogue. We also need to look at the policies we have around programming. For instance, the state has 13 opioid treatment programs in the state. Historically, they've added five more. All those are in what I would call a little more rural kind of not setting, but they're not major cities. That's where the new resources are going. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the stigma, and I just read the state's stigma approach, and they're going to focus on those communities getting the new opioid treatment programs. So in terms of minorities, the money, all those, there are minorities in Lafayette, minorities in Bloomington. Those are basically youth population, college towns, et cetera. And some of the others are smaller communities. The money's not going where the large block of minority clients are, people who are addicted. So that's one piece. I worked at a major treatment program here in town, and at one time they had a black director of nursing, a black clinical director, and a black director of detox. And they don't have that anymore, but at that time. And I was doing a focus group at a local social service agency, and one of the guys, and these mostly black guys, they said, I said, what about treatment? He said, that program is where to go. He said, people look like me are there running it and in charge making decisions, and they know how to treat African-American addiction. And I'm sharing that to say that our staffing at a lot of the programs is almost all white, even though they may deal with populations, service populations, 25, 50, or whatever percent African-American or Latino. So staffing is another issue. How do we get minority staff in administration as well as direct service? Because a lot of times minority staff are in low-level positions but not in decision-making position. And then the stigma, to me, it's a double whammy. If you're a minority, you got the addiction stigma, then you got the minority stigma, which people tend to see a violent offender for some reason. And if you're a pregnant black female, for instance, you got a triple whammy. So around stigma, so there's a lot of issues around stigma that have minority issues.
We're going to give Jocelyn her chance to speak after the break. We're talking about the opioid epidemic in Indiana and its impact on minority Hoosiers. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues. If you want to join the conversation, please give me a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Carl Ellison. He is president of the Indiana Minority Health Coalition. Stan DeKemper, who is a community health advocate and addiction expert with Mental Health America Indiana. And Jocelyn Whitaker, a community leader from Marion. Before we went to the break, I'd asked all of you how you worked through that issue of trust, particularly among minority Hoosiers who have all sorts of reasons to distrust the system, to think that it not only is not going to provide them with help, but in fact may add even greater adversity to their struggle. We got Carl's thoughts. We got Stan's thoughts. I want to get Jocelyn's before we move on.
You know, Stan said something very important, having minorities at the table. Why is that important? We are minorities. We're going to have to stop doing the missionary dummy down effect to working with minorities. And we're going to have to decide how we do this. We do it in education. My background was in education. And what we come in the door with is low expectation. Michelle Obama was here Wednesday night. I did not get the pleasure to hear her, but a friend of mine who leads our female Bible study was there. And the first thing she talked about is achieving through others' low expectations of you. A lot of times the people at the table do not have a vested interest in the minorities there. An example is one of the young lady who was Hispanic who died. She had gotten herself clean, she thought. And she reached out on Facebook telling the audience who were there, friends and so on, that she felt she was relapsing and she needed help. She had called different hospitals and programs. The problem is she was not in the throne of the crisis. She was not taking the drugs. So there was no treatment for her. Her mother left, and people had tried to surround her and support her. That's a very important thing. The parent came home, found her dead. I won't go into the graphic details, but that's a part of the treatment. We're going to have to look at who's treating whom and how we treat people. It's just like working with an alcoholic. You will always have that monkey on your back. Where is the 12-step program to help? We cannot continue to give people methadone and not have the treatment and the support and counseling needed. And minority people historically have not been people who would actually go into a treatment program with their arms wide open. They want to know, just as Stan talked about, people that look like them and who do not come in with the missionary effect, we're going to save those people. Mm-hmm. Who are those people? Those people are your neighbors. They're your mm-hmm. brothers and sisters and so on. So the way we attack the problem is going to involve public policy. It's going to involve developing relationship. It's going to involve bridging that trust gap and moving closer to the people who are involved. It's not going to be easy. We didn't get in this problem overnight, because we've had a problem with the opioids, heroin, and so on, the OxyContin, for a long time. But when it becomes a majority issue, then we decide to do something about it. Long as it's in a minority community, we don't. And poor whites are also in that category.
We are talking about Indiana's opioid epidemic and its impact on minority Hoosiers. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Will Guess, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, has done, and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Did I get your name right, sir?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Great. Great. Well, what's on your mind?
Well, I've been listening to that conversation from your show and elsewhere. And one thing I realize that is not being addressed is the injustice done to the African-American community in this situation, because in many decades, there are thousands and thousands of African-Americans that have been incarcerated due to drug possession or drug use. And these people's lives and families' lives have been ruined. And they are not given a second chance. Nobody's talking about either reducing their sentence or do something about them being incarcerated in jails. Many of the jails that are owned by white folks profiting off of that. Nobody's talking about that. Now people want me to care about drug addiction because white suburb kids are dying. It's not that I don't care, but unless this is being addressed properly and equally, I can't bring myself to care about this issue. Only.
Thanks very much for the call and question. Carl, I'm going to give you the first chance to respond.
Well, we've tried to address some of the inequities that have existed and that still exist today. And so if we didn't put enough emphasis on that, let me just sort of restate what I said in the beginning. And that is that from a policy point of view, the hope in the end is that every Hoosier who has an addiction has an equal opportunity at help for recovery. The public policy has to be to save lives. So recovery should be the paramount thing we measure. Unfortunately, with African Americans, when it comes to drug addiction, historically, it's been incarceration, it's prisons, it's punishment, it's we're going to hold you accountable and punish your way out of this, versus providing the types of a more sensitive response that Joyson and Stan have talked about in terms of access to treatment, et cetera. So I guess I would just say, Carla, the world is not fair. It is what we face. What we want to do is try to be voices to call it out for what it is and challenge the system to do better. About all we can do, because clearly sentence reduction, diversion, and other activities can be done because, again, the Stan points out, if you put people in jail but they still don't get the treatment programs, then we just got more people in jail, and that doesn't do anything to help societal productivity, let alone improve our overall health.
Jocelyn, I see you leaning in. Does that mean you want to say something?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I understand where you're coming from. I feel your pain. The reality of this situation is probably within 5 years, we in Indiana will probably move to some type of Mary J., better known as marijuana, how we look at that. And it probably will be for medical reasons and so on. With that in mind, what California has just done, they have started to look at how three strikes and you're out. Has incarcerated a lot of young black males. It has been wrong. I'm not going to say it isn't. And I think we all know we have made some people very rich because of any number of reasons why we had the marijuana on us. The thing is, once we learn what we have to do, we must be accountable and hold people accountable. That means you're going to have to go and vote. The laws are there. The laws can change. But if you choose not to vote, the same laws that are on the books will continue to stay there. And I understand your pain saying you don't care. Well, I understand that. But also understand that the opiate, and this has been a struggle for me because I'm president of our local NAACP as well as Minority Health Coalition. when a young African American's life is taken. That hurts me because I'm a mother of a son. But I also, it hurts me when a white female would be taken because I am the mother-in-law of a white female. I have a blended family. And that's very important. So it's not them against us. We're also going to have to train the people who are in the penal system because they don't historically think it will, who those who are making laws and so on, it will affect them. My legislature, when I was a legislator, made a comment to me that infuriated me, but he is willing to listen. And that's the first step. As Carl said, we have to have a conversation and be willing to understand what that conversation is going to mean. And if we have to vote people out, we have to be willing to go to the polls and not continue to be apathetic about what's going on. Collectively, we are great. By ourselves, we may be lost in the crowd.
I want to step in because, you know, this gets to one of the points that has been, you know, a sub-theme to our conversation here. And we're getting close on time. I have an entire list of emails I'd like to try to get to, too. But I think this is an important one that the caller brought up. Is this us versus them zero-sum mentality inhibiting our ability to deal with this problem in any way? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, death makes us all equal. We all face, you know, none of us have an immunity from addiction or anything like that. Real quickly, if I could ask you each, take maybe 20 seconds and just ask whether it is getting in the way of getting everyone who needs the help, that kind of help. Jocelyn.
Yes, it is. Okay. Until we are willing to invest in all the people, no matter what color they are and what social economic group they come from, we're going to continue to have the us against them.
Stan.
Yeah, I think the mood of the country is sort of a divided mood, and I think that holds true when you get into addiction, too. People focus on what's close to them and what they know best, and the internalized racism that we have in this country still drives. People are not even aware of some of the bias and the discrimination that they operate off of in programs, whether it's treatment programs, prevention programs, corrections programs. People just they don't think about it.
Carl, you get the last word.
Yeah, I think in America you always have to have hope. And, yeah, you can recognize the scars of the past and say, okay, let's talk about the future. And I think clearly what we've tried to say is that the nation just has to be more rational and the state has to be more rational in approaching this. And our call is for the public policy makers to be honest about disparate impact and to help the state create a vision and mechanisms to address that. I mean, Indiana is quite capable of doing this, as is the nation, but it requires leaders who are willing to really call the balls and strikes of what they are and to let communities know they work with them to, again, try to address this need for everybody, because the reality is unless we can reduce the inequities, we won't achieve the result of fewer deaths, fewer disability, fewer family adverse conditions that associated with this problem. And hopefully at some point we can actually begin to talk about prevention. You know, prevention. All the treatment in the world is great, but geez, if we could actually achieve and put some money toward prevention, diversion, giving everyone a shot at recovery. Everyone has a chance for recovery. If we do those things in a systematic, fair manner, that we will, in fact, breach this issue and build a trust that may help us in other areas of public health to achieve a healthier population, which helps the state overall achieve its goals of the 21st century.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Caroline. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Caroline writes, my question is for the whole panel. When trying to address the community need for substance abuse treatment and intervention, I often hear, Why provide free, low-cost intervention to drug users when chemotherapy isn't free? I'll throw that one to Stan. She concludes by saying, what is a good response to this pushback?
Well, I don't know that much about chemotherapy. I don't know about the cost of it. What I do know is that treatment saves dollars. Addiction treatment saves dollars. And some addiction treatment is publicly funded. The treatment in prisons is publicly funded. The treatment at certain community mental health centers and programs in the state is publicly funded. But the return on that is greater than the cost. The cost of the treatment is less than what it would cost if you didn't treat folks, the health conditions they would have, the criminal justice cost or whatever.
We've gotten another email from a listener who wishes to remain anonymous. This listener writes, I want to make an anonymous comment about the addiction program. Family members and friends of addicts should know that Naranon family groups exist, and there is help available at meetings around town and online. You are not alone. Other people who have been in your situation are there to provide support for each other. There is hope. I want to close this because it strikes me, if we've had people listening to this, if there's someone out there who needs help, how should they go about getting it? And we've got a little more than a minute left. Carl, I'll start with you.
Well, as a former board member, I always say just call 211. 211 is an information resource, and it's designed and aligned to link people to resources that exist statewide. So just call 211. It's 24/7. It's one way to get started. The other thing to do is obviously contact a community mental health provider, or typically just ask around. I mean, people in the community do tend to know what's out there.
How about Jocelyn and Marion, if people want help, where do they
go? If people want help, we have a hotline. And that's the statewide hotline, so that everybody gets the same, 211. There are also our medical providers. In our cases, Marion General and so on. There is also on Facebook all types of groups that are meeting and so on, trying to reach out. We've had marches. We've had praying for Marion and so on. Looking at this, because at one point we weren't.
Okay. And Stan, you get the last word. You got about 25 seconds to make it.
The state, and I dog the state out sometimes for their lack of effort or direction, but the state has a website called The Next Level, I believe it is, and it lists out all the treatment programs in the state that are available. So that would be one. And talking to folks that are in recovery is another great. Find out how they got help or whatever.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Carl Ellison, Stan DeKemper, and Jocelyn Whitaker, for what has been an enlightening and invigorating conversation about an important subject. Also like to thank our listeners. This is not going to be the last time we talk about this subject, so if we didn't get to your question or comment, we will come back. Please join us again on Thursday when we're going to be talking with former Congressman Lee Hamilton. I'm John Krall. Thank you for joining us.